Welcome to the 11KPW podcast, a community care update, including the Children and Social Work Bill, by Joanne Clement and Jonathan Auburn. This talk was given at the 11KPW Local Authority Conference on the 4th of October 2016. For more podcasts and information, please visit 11kpw.com.
Okay, there are three topics that I want to try and cover in a very rapid 15-ish minutes or so, and Jonathan is going to throw something at me if I go over my time. So, the detail is in the slides if we do gloss over some points. So the three areas I want to cover, two key cases on deprivation of liberty. This was an area I was working on before I went off on maternity leave, and I'd just like to put a marker down. Before I went on maternity leave, this was all fine. It's only gone horribly wrong since I've been away. I'm hoping to come back and fix it all. Then I'm going to talk about a case called GS and Camden. And then I'm going to talk briefly about the Children and Social Work Bill, which is currently before the House of Lords at the moment. So turning quickly then to deprivation of liberty. As any of you who work in this field know, the problems are stemming from Cheshire West, which has laid down or re-emphasised the three-stage test that is needed for a deprivation of liberty. It's there on the slide, and the case I want to talk about is the third element of the test, the necessity for any deprivation to be imputable to the state. And looking at this question of state involvement, there are essentially three aspects that the courts are trying to grapple with. There are, will be cases where there is direct involvement by a public authority who are themselves actually doing the detaining or have arranged it or are paying for it or something of that nature. There will be indirect cases where a public body is aware that someone else is depriving an individual of their liberty, and what are the obligations on local authorities in that situation. And then there is the concept of positive obligations under Article 5, which usually means that the state is required to have in place a system of law to protect against arbitrary detention. And the case that I really want to talk about is Staffordshire and SRK. I'm just going to caveat this up front by saying that this is one of the most confusing judgments that I've ever read in 15 years at the bar. It is a typical judgment from Mr. Justice Charles that is quite lengthy, and it is rather difficult to pull out of it some general principles. So I've done my best. Let's see where we get to. Essentially, in this case, SRK had been the victim of a road traffic accident, and he lives in a property that had been bought and adapted for him out of his personal injury damages award. A property and affairs deputy had been appointed, and his damages funded the care regime that were provided by the private sector. So you might look at that arrangement and say, well, what has that got to do with the state? What has that got to do with the local authority? But in answer to the question, is this confinement imputable to the state, Mr. Justice Charles said, yes, it is. And it's not quite clear why that was the case. He based it on the requirement that there are positive obligations in place to ensure that there is a regime of law, supervision and regulation to protect individuals from arbitrary detention. Well, we have that law. There are private actions, there's the Mental Capacity Act, there's the criminal law that prevents in private detention. But that, says Mr. Justice Charles, isn't enough in this case. He said that essentially where a state knows or ought to have known of private arrangements in question, then in this particular class of case, where a court has awarded damages, the cop appoints a deputy, and the deputy is under a requirement, he says, to notify a local authority who are responsible for safeguarding adults of the regime of care, then that is sufficient to bring state involvement into play. And as he goes on to say, a local authority must then make an application to the Court of Protection for an order authorising the deprivation of liberty. Now, going through the judgment, he looked at questions about when there will be direct state responsibility, and I've set those out there on the slide, essentially when the state is directly participating as a decision maker. Then it's fairly obvious. Then the state is responsible. There needs to be a court order authorising any deprivation. It gets more complicated when we're looking at the positive obligations and the indirect responsibility. And what Mr. Justice Charles says in this case is that where there is the deputy in this situation, the deputy is under an obligation as part of their duties to make the local authority with the safeguarding role aware of the situation. The local authority must check whether there are less restrictive arrangements that could possibly be put in place. And he says then, and it's the third bullet point on this slide, that the local authority with the safeguarding role will know or ought to have known of the situation, and it's this that triggers the obligations to investigate, to support, and this is a direct quote, and sometimes to make an application to the Court of Protection. But what the judge doesn't do is give any further guidance about when or what circumstances trigger that obligation, beyond saying that on the facts of this particular case, where there is the deputy involvement and the deputy must notify the local authority, that an application must be made to the court. So the judge he recognised that he was putting more obligations on deputies than local authorities or health bodies, but he seemed to think that the effect of his judgment wouldn't be that significant, as he said there were only about 300 cases with professional deputies administering this kind of award across the country. But when one takes the logic of his judgment to its natural conclusion, he seems to be saying that there will be obligations on local authorities in all cases where they are aware or ought to be aware of private arrangements on the ground. And so the implications of what he's saying seem to me to be far more significant. Perhaps because of that, the Secretary of State, who is a party to this case, has appealed against the decision, and that appeal is due to be heard by the Court of Appeal at the end of next month. So watch this space. The next area I want to talk about is how a public body goes about actually getting court authorisation for a deprivation of liberty that isn't covered by the Dolls regime. Most of you will be aware of the REX streamlined process that was set up, and this was the issue about whether P had to be a party to proceedings or not. The Court of Appeal said that P did have to be a party, but there was then a new Rule 3A put in place in the Court of Protection rules that set out different ways of ensuring the participation of P, mainly in this case through the appointment of lay representatives who can provide the court with information about P's wishes and feelings, or to do any other things that the judge would direct them to do. And a series of test cases were listed again before Mr. Justice Charles in the RE-NRA case. And what the judge held there is that a Rule 3A representative can meet the requirements of Article 5 and the common law. So P doesn't have to be a party to proceedings with a litigation friend, with the involvement of the official solicitor, if there is a family member or some other friend who can act in this representative role. And in NRA, Mr. Justice Charles said that, well, if there isn't a family member or friend, there's still probably not a need to make P a party because the court could obtain the necessary information through Section 49 reports or through witness summonses. That, however, wasn't the end of the matter, and the JM case is where this impasse really came about. There were a series of cases where there was no one who would act as a Rule 3A representative, and the official solicitor said, I'm not going to do it. And what the court held is that a fair procedure must involve assistance from someone on the ground who considers the care package through P's eyes. And the judge was very critical of central government for not addressing the practical availability of Rule 3A representatives and accused them of seeking to pass responsibility off to local government. This, it seems to me, is what Mr. Justice Charles seems to think is happening. The small child is central government. The I can't see any problem here is local government. But essentially what he has done in the order made in the JM case and orders that will now be made in all subsequent cases is he has joined the Secretary of State as a party to proceedings, invited all the parties to identify an immediately available Rule 3A representative or some alternative procedure, and stayed all of these applications until those steps have been taken with liberty to apply. So the court's saying, we're not dealing with this, and at that point the government was saying, well, we're not dealing with it either. But essentially, the judge set out a long list of options open to the government as to what they could do to resolve this situation. And as I understand it, the government has decided not to appeal against this decision. So we can only assume that at some point, one of these options will be taken, one or possibly more, will be taken by the government. And it will then be open to see whether that satisfies Mr. Justice Charles and what happens going forward. So it really is a case of watch this space. The second area I want to talk about is the case of GS against Camden. The facts are up there on the slide. It's quite an extreme case on the facts because GS was an EEA national, but she couldn't be returned to Switzerland because she didn't have capacity to decide whether to return or to consent to mental health treatment as a result of her severe mental health issues. The local authority conducted a Care Act assessment, but decided that her sole need was for accommodation, which it said did not fall within the Care Act, and which it concluded it had no power to provide. GS argued that care and support, the term in the Care Act, was broad enough to include a need for simple accommodation. And there were then also arguments about the scope of the general power of competence and that the local authority's refusal to exercise that power amounted to a breach of Article 3 of the Convention. The court held that the need for care and support, so the key phrase in the Care Act, does not encompass only a need for accommodation. So a need for accommodation alone is not a need for care and support under the Care Act. So it's adopting the same approach that had been taken under the National Assistance Act regime and M and Slough, etc., and applied it to the Care Act. And the fact that Section 8 of the Care Act lists accommodation as an example of how care and support could be provided is simply that. It's just an example. It's not saying that that is a list of what counts as care and support. It's just a means by which care and support can itself be provided. Moving on then to the more controversial aspect of the case, in my view, the use of the general power of competence. Now, under Section 2 of the Localism Act, GPOC doesn't enable a local authority to do anything which it's unable to do by virtue of a post-commencement limitation. And we talked, Nigel talked earlier this morning about limitations and restrictions, etc. But the important point for these purposes is where it's a post-commencement limitation, so where the Act postdates the Localism Act, it's only a limitation which is expressed to apply to the general power. So the court here said that because the Care Act does not itself expressly refer to the Localism Act and the exercise of the general power of competence, then it did not contain a post-commencement limitation. Now, there are, it seems to me, a number of difficulties with this analysis. The first is that the court had already found that this need for accommodation wasn't, in fact, a need for care and support under the Care Act, so there was no power to provide it under the Care Act. So I don't quite understand why the judge was looking at whether the Care Act contained any express limitations on the exercise of the power when he'd already found it was nothing to do with the Care Act at all. If she's looking solely for accommodation, it seems to me that this is a Housing Act matter, which would be a pre-commencement limitation because the Housing Acts predate the Localism Act, and then there would not have been this need for an express limitation on the exercise of the GPOC. But that wasn't something that the judge looked at. And so at the moment, you have these two standalone regimes that the judge says will be in play in terms of you've got first look at the Care Act and how you provide care and support or how you meet care and support needs. But you also have to look at the Localism Act and see whether there is whether the power to provide something under the Localism Act is converted into a duty by virtue of the Human Rights Act. Because the way the argument went in this case is that it would be a breach of Article 3 of the Convention not to exercise the general power of competence to provide the accommodation. And the court looked at the typical case law under Article 3, including Limbuela, and held that even though a lack of accommodation on its own won't automatically result in a breach of Article 3, it did on the particular facts of this case. And I've set out a summary of the facts here. The local authority had also argued that it wasn't a breach of Section 3 because GS had benefits available to her, but the court found as a fact that even if she'd put her entire weekly benefit into accommodation, she would have been unable to find accommodation that was suitable for her disabilities and unable to fund any other necessities. So it's a very interesting case about how the Localism Act sits alongside the Care Act. Finally, very briefly, the Children and Social Work Bill. It's currently before the House of Lords, completed the committee stage, and the report stage is due to take place on the 18th of October. I've set out the purposes of the bill on this slide, and then the three areas that are being covered. A few points to draw out from the bill. It's going to introduce a framework of corporate parenting principles that are going to overlay the existing duties of local authorities that are owed to children and care leavers. It's essentially in the same structure as the Care Act, so a requirement to have regard to the need to do various things rather than a duty to do various things. And I've set those out on the slide there. There is also going to be a requirement to consult on and publish a local offer for care leavers, so very similar to the local offer that you have under the Children and Families Act. Some amendments to requirements on duties owed to former relevant children, and various things that education need to be done in schools. The most controversial aspect of the bill at the moment is the power to test different ways of working, or as it's being colloquially referred to, the bonfire of child protection rights. Essentially, it is a power in the bill to allow the Secretary of State to make regulations exempting a local authority from any and all requirements imposed under children's social care legislation or to modify the way in which it applies. And it could allow a local authority to avoid these duties for up to a 6-year period. It has to be for the purpose of achieving a better outcome or the same outcomes more efficiently. But as I say, it is highly controversial if it does disapply the very basics of child protection law as is known at the moment. The other key point, there are currently proposals to establish a central child safeguarding practice review panel, which is a bit of a mouthful, but essentially abolishing local safeguarding children's boards, setting up local equivalents, but also having the national oversight where there are particularly serious cases and national guidance is required. Finally, there are proposals to set up new regulation of social workers and setting up a specialist social work regulator, taking it out of the Health and Care Professions Council. As I say, more of the detail is on the slides, but I am now going to hand over to Jonathan before he does throw something at my head. There we go.
Thank you, Joe.
Can you all hear me at the back?
Good, I hope. I was very impressed with Joe keeping to timing very well. I'd said a number of times, you know, just reminding her of how little time we've got, because I was absolutely sure she was going to go over by an insane amount of time. But no, she's pretty much to the minute, as I can see it. It's 3:16, so I'm very impressed indeed. Joe's covered dolls and adults, in case on developments on adults, largely, and the bill. And I've been given children and recent cases, developments involving community care and children. Those are the six points that I've picked out. Well, I've got children and ordinary residents, which fits together in some sort of way, I suppose. I'm not planning on giving you all six of those because I've got 15 minutes and it's just not possible. So I figure I've got time for three. Maybe if you're really, really lucky or unlucky, you'll get a fourth. So I want to get to OR at the end. So I'm planning on doing the first two. Maybe duty to runaways, if we have time and if you want it, and make sure we cover the last one as well. And that's what we'll do in the time. John and I have prepared fairly detailed notes in the handout, and the point of that being if we do skip over some areas, which we have done, hopefully at least have the information there, and if you want, you can always buttonhole us afterwards. So the first one I've got to cover is age assessments and the Croydon case. Well, almost all the age assessment cases are Croydon cases in one way or another. And there, I'm sure whether you act for claimants or defendants, you're all well versed in the unpredictability or the lottery that is age assessment litigation. For those of you who aren't familiar with it, they're not normal judicial review cases. They're not normal really in any sense. And they're very unpredictable because a normal judicial review, the judge looks at the grounds of challenge, works out according with the margin of discretion and Wensbury and law, things like law, where the grounds are made out. Age assessments are more just, I'm the judge, there's a young person in front of me, is he or she over or under 18? And that's it, pretty much. I've had these trials before, and I sat in the court for 2 days, and I've really wondered what's going through the judge's mind. I'm not sure I'm any much the wiser. The key thing is it's very hard to predict in advance which way a case is going to go. Permission stage, you can predict it because you can say, well, these are the grounds, they're good or bad. Substantive stage, you're in a trial, judge, young person, it's really hard to work out what the judge is going to think of the young person. This case is interesting for the issue of expert evidence, and it might be useful or relevant in a wider setting. What happened in this case is there was an age assessment trial listed, I think it was for February 2016, for a four-day trial, witness action trial, just on the issue of age. The claimant had already had a bulk of expert evidence. He already had three expert reports of different types. And the local authority pretty much hadn't got anything. Croydon had done their assessment initially based on visual assessment only, not the full, more lengthy process which is normally done. The local authority wanted to prepare for the trial and wanted to get in a bulk of expert evidence, dental examination, full social worker assessment, psychiatrist, and the claimant wasn't cooperating. As is not uncommon, actually, and particularly if you do education SEN work. You see, it's not unusual for people to say, well, actually, you know what, you've had your chance to see this young person. You should have done it a year ago. That's not an uncommon position for claimants to take. That was sort of the position here. There wasn't much cooperation. So the local authority, Croydon, put in an application to say, well, if you're not going to cooperate or... claims not going to cooperate, the case should be stayed or struck out. And they went to the... this was initially in the upper tribunal. So I think the notes have initially said admin court. It was the first instance was the upper tribunal. The upper tribunal judge, in very brief reasoning, said, oh, it just seems a bit too harsh, what you're asking for, all these examinations. I think it's a bit much. I'm not going to grant it. Went to the Court of Appeal with a bit more examination of things like law and legal principles. Shocking. And Croydon was saying, well, there is some authority here, STAR, National Coal Board, which is about a party's fundamental right to participate in litigation. And the Court of Appeal rather liked that sort of fairness argument and said, well, yes, actually, it should have actually been imposed this order of stay or strike out if you don't cooperate. Now, the question is... So Croydon won on that occasion in the Court of Appeal, got their order, up tribunal was overturned. The question is, how far could local authorities take this to say, age assessments are actually in similar trials where there's an issue of fact, to say, you, young person or other claimant, got to submit yourself to these examinations, or I'm going to do something nasty with the court. I'm going to get the court to do something nasty to you. I'd urge some caution, whether it's to local authorities thinking of doing something like this, and also to claimants if you find yourself in this position, because Croydon was a slightly unusual case on the facts, particularly the claimant already had, it was a forensic physician's report, a psychiatric report, and an expert on trafficking, already banked up and ready to go. And as I said, Croydon had pretty much nothing. So there's a big, big disparity in the evidence, and that was, I think, relevant. I'm not sure you would necessarily get the same result in what is the more typical situation of a normal local authority social worker report and age assessment, and the local authority simply want to prepare for trial and want to get a bit more evidence beyond that they've already got. We'll see. The other reason why this is a slightly unusual case is the decision and the reasoning of the upper tribunal judge was very, very weak indeed. So the issues are the requests reasonable or unreasonable? in that case, the Court of Appeal wasn't that interested really in a forensic examination of everything the local authority had or hadn't done, because they just thought that, well, it was fair enough to want this information. I do query the necessity of having three experts. I know age assessment trials are inherently massively disproportionate in terms of time and money, but even still, it was quite significant, and there wasn't really much discussion of that. And the last point is joint experts. I don't really hear... there was no discussion of that. It seems an obvious thing in a case like this. It might have been because claimant had already got a lot of the evidence they wanted. So a lot more, I think, to go on that, a lot more of working out how these strange and massively disproportionate age assessment trials are to be done. Next case, Jalal, which Jalal and I think it was Greenwich from memory. Yeah, Jalal and Greenwich, on destitution. And this is part of a growing body of case law in which a local authority says, well, you say you're desperate, you say the family's desperate, it's a Section 17 case, child in need case, the family's saying they're destitute, we actually don't really believe you. We think you've got these other means of support, we think you could access some support here, you could do this or that or whatever, and because we don't believe you, we're not going to do anything for you. And there have been a couple of cases on this recently. There's been Owen Lambeth, there's been a case called Antoine, which isn't very well reported, earlier this year. So there are cases in which local authority decisions have been upheld on a Wednesbury rational basis. That was the case roughly in Jalal, that the local authority refused support for those reasons. You see, I've been having fun working out my graphics here. The local authority said the child wasn't in need because there was some support available. Oh, I quite like that one. So that they decided the parent could support if needed. And they had done quite a lot. The claimant had set out what steps they had taken, but the local authority had quite a detailed decision letter saying, actually, we don't really believe you. And they had some quite detailed, thorough reasons for that. Ultimately, that was upheld by the court. It was a Section 17 case, as mentioned. There were some basic statements, basic principle on Section 17, which shouldn't be a surprise to many people. It was a fairly factual case, basically looking at the reasons the parents had given, the reasoning of the local authority and the adequacy of the reasoning. It's not the basic theme of it was it wasn't enough for the parents to say, well, we've lost our accommodation, therefore the children are in need. And there's much more detailed examination of that and the steps taken, the reasonableness of securing accommodation. But in short, local authority issued a detailed decision on veracity, on what they believed to be the case. That was upheld on a fairly traditional Wednesbury-type basis, which is how the cases have gone in the last year or two. The wider picture. Is there a wider picture? There must be. I've got some notes on it. The line of recent cases. I've mentioned the other two, Owen Lambeth and Antoine. What I would say is that local authorities need to be a little bit careful that they shouldn't take this as carte blanche to say, in fairly peremptory form, we don't believe you, therefore we're denying support. Oh, and by the way, we've got some cases which support us on that, so we're okay. That would be an unfortunate way of thinking, and I would say for claimants, they should watch out for that type of thinking, because in each of these cases, the local authorities had done a fair bit of groundwork. They had built up solid factual bases for their views on disbelieving the claimant family, the parents essentially. And it was only because they'd done that groundwork and built that up that they got through on these cases. But at the end of the day, it's straight Wednesbury unreasonableness on this issue. There isn't a great deal more on that. And I think provided local authorities do that groundwork, they can rely on this line of cases. The final point to mention on Jalal is there was an Article 8 point, which said, well, you can imagine the obvious Article 8 point, and the judgment was it wasn't a breach of Article 8 to deny accommodation to the children, sorry, deny accommodation to the parents on the basis that you'll accommodate the children. So it's not the first time a local authority has said, okay, well, even if you're saying everything you're saying is true and correct, we would accommodate the children, but not the parents. And the obvious response to that is you're splitting up the family. Jalal affirmed that logic, affirmed that approach, and it's consistent with previous case law on that. I think that takes me... That was the second of the three things I wanted to cover. And I think I'm going to skip over the other points and get to, as I said, I wanted to make sure I cover Cornwall. Now regretting all the fancy graphics I stuck in. There we are. Cornwall and ordinary residents. We've got about 5 minutes, if Jonathan will permit me. Yes, thank you. On ordinary residents in the Cornwall case. Now, Cornwall obviously isn't new this month, this year, but we thought it'd be useful to touch base with it because it's obviously very, very important to everyone that practices in this area. It's a useful, as a refresher or a reminder of the basics of Cornwall and ordinary residents. I've given you the basic provisions under the Care Act, regulations and guidance. Section 39 is the deeming provision and 40 is the dispute resolution. We've got transitional regulations, specified accommodation regulations which support Section 39 and deeming. So if a person has been in certain types of accommodation, supported living, other types, then they're deemed to have been ordinary resident where they were before effectively. Disputes between authorities and the guidance. The guidance, if you're not very familiar with this and you have to grapple with ordinary residents or OR, I can recommend Chapter 19 and Annex H because it's a readable piece which you can just pick up and work through. And it also describes Cornwall in a fairly readable fashion. Cornwall in a nutshell. Yeah, I'm okay for time, I think. The issue, ordinary residence for adults lacking mental capacity to make decisions as to residence. There was a hugely complicated background or history to how this came about, this ordinary residence dispute came about. There were three or four, I think, authorities in the frame at different times. And ultimately, the Supreme Court plumped for the one which no one had really seen on the radar going along. And there were each different court had gone for someone else. So chaos, confusion, all judges reaching slightly different decisions along the way. Young person had been placed in care, foster care or care for a large part of his youth from a young age, and there had been numerous moves throughout youth and then going to adulthood. Again, I won't take you through the tortured history of it, but in a nutshell, the Supreme Court plumped for ordinary residence on the local authority that had originally placed and arranged the young person way back in the eons of time as a child. And there had been more than one local authority involved in his care as a child. So it wasn't local authorities that were later caring for him as a child or as an adult. It was the original one from way back earlier. And the key passages, which are useful, there are only four paragraphs. Paragraph 51, the seat of decision-making power in relation to the mentally disabled adult is the authority making the placement, not the parents. Because before this decision, there'd been a lot of talk and decisions about looking to where the parents lived for a mentally disabled adult. One of the outcomes of Cornwall is to dampen or discard that approach. So not really looking to the parents, but the decision-making power or placing authority originally. And it's not a narrow principle. So if you're in dispute with a local authority and you think you're on the right side of Cornwall and they're distinguishing it on fairly narrow grounds, which I've got two of those at the moment where that's happening, bear in mind that it's quite clear reading the judgment as a whole, and it's only a very short judgment, that the Supreme Court intended to lay down a fairly broad principle. They talk about the underlying purpose here, authorities not being able to export responsibility, and that supported their view that responsibility should be with the local authority that had been responsible way back many, many years ago. So it's intended to be a fairly wide principle. supported by the policy in the Act. Accommodation isn't affected by the location of a placement. The adverse consequences, it's highly regrettable if people, local authorities, are constrained in their willingness to receive children. So it's intended to be a broad principle. So I wouldn't encourage attempts to distinguish it in a dispute narrowly. What we know, well, the deeming provisions, formerly the National Assistance Act, Section 24(5), now the Care Act, Section 39, are certainly front and central and can assist or can carry you way back in time, decades in fact. And care in terms of the young person's base. Now, I think it's the third point, really, that the previous approach of looking or placing some reliance on where the parent lived has pretty much gone, or indeed the deputy, but I don't really see cases involving deputies. And the penultimate point there, we're talking about ordinary residents for adults that have been in the system and are lacking capacity. The issue, I think, must be whether they have or had capacity at relevant time to decide where they live. I think that's obvious. That's the capacity issue that's been mentioned, discussed, and it's the only one that could be relevant. I say that because we've got a case at the moment where we're saying that, the other local authority is saying, but we had a capacity assessment 2 years ago in which we found he had capacity to sign a tenancy agreement. Notwithstanding, the Court of Protection decided that he lacked capacity to decide where he lives. So you can imagine our response to that. The relevant issue is residence. Finally, the guidance. As I said, the guidance, Annex H, is very useful for this. It talks about transition of young people into adulthood, and paragraph 41 is worth a read, and it talks about the linking of young adults and their children regime. And it says there's some sort of preliminary assumption that you will follow the way things were going in the children regime, and that's probably going to have some power. That is Cornwall in a nutshell, and now I think, yes, magically, as I intended, 35 minutes past, with Jonathan to finish up on the much more interesting Brexit.